application, our calendar is 00-1853-2187, Mark DeCastro versus Wellston City School District Board of Education. Mr. Sillery.
If it pleases the court, my name is James Sillery. I represent the Wellston City School District Board of Education. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes if I may. The surviving claim of the appellee is a cause of action for hurt feelings couched in breach of contract terms. The appellee admitted at summary judgment that he had no cause of action in tort for these same hurt feelings. The issue is, should he be able to maintain an action in contract, and in this case as a third-party beneficiary, for these hurt feelings when he admits that he had no actual damages? The trial court said no in granting summary judgment to the school district. All judges of the Fourth District Court of Appeals indicated that the law should be that actual damages should be required in a contract case, but reversed the trial court on the basis of the 1876 Supreme Court case of First National Bank of Barnesville versus the Western Union Telegraph Company, which states that a plaintiff can get nominal damages in a breach of contract case if he has no actual damages.
If we follow the Barnesville case, you lose. If we overrule it, you win.
Well, I think we win even if you would refine the Barnesville case. I think that there are certain contract cases where nominal damages may well be appropriate. I don't believe that that's true in this case.
You argue that in your brief? I think you ask us to overrule Barnesville.
Well, I think in proposition number one, we ask you to overrule Barnesville. Proposition number two, we ask that you revisit Barnesville and perhaps refine it. I think in cases where the action of the person who breaches the contract might be willful or wanton, or if there is a legal interest or legal right to be vindicated, that in those cases there may be appropriate cases for awarding nominal damages in breach of contract cases.
Except you say in that proposition law to must allege actual damages. That sounds to me like you have to have an award before there can be.
Well, I do believe there is authority for granting nominal damages in breach of contract cases where you do not have actual damages.
Okay. Well, your proposition says actual damages. Fine.
Why revisit Barnesville after all this time? And I think that there are a number of reasons for doing so. First of all, there are 5 different courts of appeals decisions in the state within the last 15 or 16 years that have required actual damages to be proven in breach of contract cases. These cases are the 6th District case of Munoz versus Flower Hospital, a 1985 case, a 9th District case of Textron versus Nationwide Insurance Company, a 3rd District Court of Appeals case in Logston versus Ohio Northern University, a 1990 case, Hackathorn versus Springfield Local School District, a 9th District Court of Appeals case in 1994, and Donor versus SNAP, also a 1994 case from the 2nd District Court of Appeals. All of these cases ultimately dismissed the plaintiff's case for failure to prove actual damages. The language at page 168 in the Munoz case is fairly consistent with all the cases. It says, in order for an individual to recover on a contract cause of action, it is necessary to show that individual has been damaged by a breach of that contract. I think the court in the Textron case at page 144 is a little bit instructive to us here. It says, while Nationwide is technically guilty of 4 of the above contract violations, we hold that Textron failed to prove damages as a result of Nationwide's breach. And I think that the use of the word technically is important because I think, as I just mentioned a moment ago, that when considering whether a case is appropriate for nominal damages, I think you have to look at the motivation, perhaps, of the defendant in the case, whether his actions were willful. And certainly in Textron, they said this is just a technical violation, and therefore, this case, we're going to insist that actual damages be proved. Well, why else should this court revisit Barnesville? And I think this case is a case for hurt feelings, and as I mentioned, the appellee indicated at summary judgment he didn't have a cause of action in tort for those same hurt feelings. And I think that the reasoning that went into those tort cases is applicable here. And that reasoning is that courts can't remedy every ill that we have, that there has to be something substantial to the case. And in those negligent and intentional infliction of emotional distress cases, the courts have said, first of all, the conduct of the defendant has to be outrageous. Secondly, it says that the harm, the emotional harm that's caused, has to be a serious emotional harm. And I think that if you're going to allow a contract case to proceed without proof of actual damages, that there has to be something pretty significant within the way of the conduct of the defendant, or whether or not you have a very significant legal right that needs to be vindicated. And I think, lastly, we should revisit it by, you just have to look at the facts of this particular case. Here you have a young man whose teachers at his school went on strike. And even though school was in session that day and he knew that classes were in session, he decided he wasn't going to attend school. But he did go to the school at the end of the school day and went around to the rear of the school building where the substitute teachers were being escorted out. And he engaged in conduct in which he admittedly violated the student code of conduct. And he was subsequently punished for that violation of the code of conduct. And he admits that he suffered no damages as a result of the punishment that he got. And yet, he's been able to file a lawsuit against the school district. We've litigated through the summary judgment at the trial court level, meetings, depositions, court appearance. We've gone through the Court of Appeals, and now we're here before the Supreme Court for a young man who intentionally did something that he admits was wrong pursuant to the code of conduct. Here, he has no legal right to be vindicated.
This wouldn't seem to be the kind of conduct, I know that's not the issue before us, but it doesn't seem to be the kind of type of conduct for which the clause in the teacher school board agreement was written, would have it, that there wouldn't be sanctions against teachers, students, parents, and others for conduct during a strike. I would think that would be the student carries a sign in favor of the teachers or whatever.
That was the next point I was going to make.
That's okay. You agree? I guess with that.
Oh, absolutely. The agreement that was reached when the strike was settled indicated that the school, its agents, and employees would not make any reprisals against students or teachers or the association. This was not an amnesty clause. It was a reprisal. It was a retaliatory type of act against an individual. And in fact, if this were a retaliatory type of act, then perhaps that might be that legal right that needs to be vindicated. But since it is not, there is no legal right to be vindicated.
Well, I guess wouldn't he claim that his suspension, his in-school suspension, would be retaliation?
Well, the in-school suspension was certainly not
pursuant to the code, but I, you know, his argument has to be that was.
Well, I think that it is
conduct, but
I don't know that anyone would suggest that during a strike that the student code of conduct would be suspended and that the the school district couldn't enforce its rules and regulations.
Yeah, but the amnesty clause, interestingly enough, includes any action or activity by or failure to act occurring during the activity by employees, parents, and students. This action occurred during the strike activity.
Yes, but it's not an amnesty clause. It's a non-reprisal clause. And it's a big difference between a non-reprisal clause and an amnesty clause.
What kind of reprisal would have been taken against a teacher? Let's assume the teacher was at fault here. Firing?
Well, or perhaps you don't promote that teacher that might be entitled to a promotion.
So, suspending a student wouldn't be reprisal?
No, sir. It's frankly what that student deserved. He admitted he violated the code of conduct. He had it wasn't a suspension, by the way, it was a 4-day in-school restriction,
yeah,
in which he was entitled to complete all of his work and suffered no penalty whatsoever with regards to lessening of grades or anything of that nature.
Assuming the fact pattern I gave you, the teacher was wrong too.
If the teacher...
Would it be reprisal against the teacher to not promote the teacher or to discharge the teacher?
I think that if someone commits a wrong during the strike, that wrong could be remedied. But I think that a reprisal would be that if you're participating in the strike, and because you participate in the strike, we're going to take some other action against you that was taken solely because you participated in the strike.
If it were the intention of the parties and nothing arising out of the strike should be actionable, how could they have written any broader amnesty clause, for lack of a better term?
Well, I think that to make it broader, you would call it an amnesty clause. Here they said we will take no reprisals. And again, I think a reprisal is a retaliatory type of action. I think to suggest that anything that happened, if you violate the code of conduct, and the young man admitted, yes, I knew I violated the code of conduct. And frankly, I think he went there looking for that. For that problem. And I don't think that this is a reprisal at all. I think it's an enforcement of the code of conduct that was in place at the time. So I'd urge the court to find that this is that type of case that requires actual damages to be proved and to reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you, Mr. Sillery. Mr. Steele.
May it please the court, my name is William Steele. I'm joined at council table by Rory Callahan, and together we represent the appellee in this case, Mark DeCastro. Your Honors, the issue before this court is whether the sanctity of a promise and contract is dependent merely upon the presence of monetary loss. The question that this court must ask itself and be satisfied with its answer is whether there is a compelling reason to abandon what has been well-established law in Ohio for 125 years. And we believe when this case is examined and when the public policy considerations underlying contract law are examined, there is no compelling reason to abandon First National Bank of Barnesville versus Western Union Telegraph Company.
Why is this not a good case to do just the opposite, to say that there's nothing to be gained here by this case being brought to the Supreme Court all the way through the court system? He had no tort action, so he tries a third-party beneficiary action under contract. He was clearly wrong, and now we've got an issue of law that seems to me to question whether, as the Court of Appeals said, they apply the old law, which they had to, but they did it begrudgingly. This case doesn't really cry out for us to apply the law, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it does, because I think any contract case should be decided under this established principles of contract law, specifically what the purpose of contract law is, and that is that liability is imposed by law for the protection of a single limited interest, and that is of having the promises of others enforced, the promises of others performed. And for that reason, the well-settled law, not only in Ohio since 1876, but as stated in sources such as the Restatement, Farnsworth on contracts, Prosser and Keaton, is that nominal damages allow vindication of those rights. When you're talking about tort law, for example, tort law is concerned with the allocation of losses arising out of human activities. There's no enforceable right until there's a loss. But when you're talking about contract law, again, you're going back to a very simple premise, and that is the sanctity of a promise.
Well, counsel, this, I think we have competing competing axioms. We have the axiom that says that damages, contract damages must be proved with specificity, you know, that we don't award speculative damages. And likewise, we have established a body of law with regard to vindication of one's feelings, particularly. This is usually with regard to emotional distress, either negligent or intentional infliction. And that whole line of cases with Pavi Hanks, and they insist that it be serious, that it can't be trivial or a mere hurt feeling. So we have these competing precepts that would suggest your general precept that we vindicate might not be as solid as it might have been in the 19th century.
Well, Your Honor, I understand that the state of the law has changed, but I believe that there still is the concept underlying contract law concerning the sanctity of promise. And the problem that this case presents is that if you start taking the approach that Mr. Sillery takes and the appellant takes in this case, on the one hand, they argue you should totally overrule Barnesville. And then on the other hand, they almost argue a case-by-case examination. He suggests whether the conduct is willful and wanted. I think you have to draw a bright line. And the bright line either has to be nominal damages are available in contract or they aren't available
in
contract.
When you say nominal, interestingly, in torts, in tort cases, personal injury cases, for example, where the injury is proved, we often have, you know, the cost of the stitches or, you know, there is some evidence or some basis for the nominal damages. Where in a contract case where you say there is no economic loss, from the only place to go for choosing a number is this trivial feeling kind of idea, which we have knocked out in other areas of the law,
mm-hmm.
in the tort, at least in the tort area.
Mm-hmm.
What number would you use?
Well,
when you say nominal, what are you going to base it on?
Well, I think the instruction is that it can be as small as $1, and that's up for the jury to determine, and there have been a number
well,
of cases.
Well, you'd have to have something to make it more than a dollar, wouldn't you? You'd have to have some evidence.
No. Our position is very simple, Your Honor. Our position is on nominal damages cases, you're saying you either cannot measure or you cannot prove what the amount of the loss is. In any event, the law of contract...
No economic loss.
Right.
No economic loss.
No economic loss. That's correct. Because the purpose of contract law is to promote enforcing the promise that's made.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, I think it's important to examine a couple of things. In the general sense, there's been no demonstration that there is a flood of cases coming into the courts asking for nominal damages in contract. But specifically, the appellant in this case has argued that school districts are a possible target for a flood of litigation involving nominal damages contracts cases. And there's certainly nothing to support that in the record, and there's nothing to support that in this courtroom. There's no amicus curiae of other school boards coming in here and saying this is a large problem, because quite frankly, it is not.
It is merely in this case one party has attempted to assert its right in contract. There is no flood of litigation that this court is going to prevent by overruling the Barnesville case. The other thing that's important in the questions that Justice Douglas and Justice Moyer asked is, I think as far as the non-reprisal clause is concerned, there's a factual question here whether or not it's implicated in this case. The lower courts didn't address that, and as Justice Douglas pointed out, the language of this non-reprisal clause, which the appellant agreed to, negotiated and agreed to, is broad enough that a cause of action can be brought, and it's up to the trier of fact to determine whether or not that clause was violated in this particular instance.
If the student here had physically injured someone in the course of his conduct, would he be immune from or exempt or somehow not liable for his conduct?
Well, for one thing, he would have faced the possibility of criminal charges. To another extent, the other party would have the opportunity to bring a civil lawsuit against him. Then the question would be whether or not the school board could act to discipline him and whether or not that was a reprisal under this language. So there would be a factual question related to the school board, but there is not any exemption from criminal liability or civil liability flowing from the person that he would assault. In your hypothetical.
So you'd have us draw a line between civil or criminal liability and a student conduct code.
When you have a non-reprisal clause that the appellant agrees to that is as broad as this, yes, I would have you draw that line.
The school board should have made an exception for the student code is what you'd argue, I guess, or what?
Well, the school board cannot retaliate or act in, cannot engage in a reprisal against the student, and if the facts supported that there was a reprisal under your scenario, then it's possible that yes, they could try to seek haven under that. But I think there's clearly a distinction here as far as the facts, because the facts here are the student went to a particular spot, an altercation began, and all that occurred was verbal exchanges between the student and the teacher. And I think one of the things that you can look at, as you would look at it in this case, is whether there was any action taken against this teacher. When Mr. Sillery says the teacher wouldn't be promoted, that's kind of misguided, because this is a replacement teacher that we're talking about who came in to replace a teacher who was on strike.
I think it was an abstract question. I think in response to Justice Douglas's question that What sort of reprisals could a teacher be subject to?
Well, I'm suggesting is that you could look at a number of different things to determine whether, in fact, there was a reprisal, such as whether or not that teacher was dismissed or not brought back at that point in time, or whether he continued to teach during the remainder of the strike. I think those are all things that you could weigh in determining whether or not this was a reprisal.
By the nominal damages, what you're really seeking is the right to a moral victory, a statement to the world that this contract was breached and you were in the right, sort of more of a reputation salvage rather than an economic issue. That's really what you're looking for.
That's one way to look at it, Your Honor, and the way we prefer to look at it is to enforce the sanctity of entering into this agreement. And we think that the law of contract, as it's developed over time and has been the law of this state for 125 years, is the law of contract supports that type of action. Unless there are any questions, we would respectfully urge the court to affirm the holding of First National Bank of Barnesville and affirm the decision of the court below and hold that nominal damages are available in a breach of contract action.
Thank you, Mr. Steele.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sillery, you've saved almost a little over two and a half minutes of your time.
Your Honor, I would only be repeating things that I said before, and so I'd waive any further time unless there are other questions.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.